In some of the forgotten corners of Flanders fields, we look at the war beneath the Western Front with the tunnellers, the men who held the line and are buried in the small soldiers' cemeteries of the Great War, and those who flew above the battlefields, the men of the Royal Flying Corps, who took the war to the skies above the Messines Ridge. For the first time this season, we've returned to the battlefields in Flanders, and we're south of the city of Ypres, in the village of Witschater, or White Sheets, as the British soldier called it, during the First World War. Those Tommies of the Great War struggled to pronounce many of these names in Belgium and France, just like we do today. And for those of you who often follow these podcast walks on Google Earth, I've actually, for the first time, put together a map with the route on, so you know where I start from, where we go. There's a slight adaptation because it wouldn't let me take us through a particular minor road past a farm, but you'll get the rough idea. And I hope to continue to do those kind of maps, as they were a lot simpler to do than I must confess I thought they were, for future podcasts where we walk the battlefields. So where are we? Well, we're in the village of Witschater, White Sheets, and we're standing outside the church in the very heart of the village, and we're in front of a memorial that shows a kneeling soldier with an entrenching tool in his hand. And this village is atop the Messines Ridge, where in June 1917, on the 7th of June, 19 mines were blown along that ridge, creating the largest man-made explosion in the history of the Great War on the Western Front. These 19 mines totaled nearly £1 million of explosive, and they destroyed German positions along the ridge. That, in combination with the bombardment and the advances in the cooperation between infantry, tanks, artillery, aircraft, enabled the men to move forward and capture the ridge in a single day. We've looked at elements of the Battle of Messines before, and we will no doubt return to them. But the tunnellers who prepared those 19 mines were never properly commemorated on this battlefield. And this is a modern memorial, a bit of modern sculpture, symbolising one of these miners in his tunnels, working away at the mining face, digging that tunnel towards the enemy positions. Now, the tunnellers in the British Army in the Great War was something that didn't exist when Britain went to war in 1914. There was, of course, the Royal Engineers, but there were no tunnelling units in it. Because why would you need tunnellers in what was going to be a very mobile war, typical of wars that Britain had fought in the preceding century? But of course, that was not the war that the Great War would rapidly turn into. It became a static war, a trench war, and 450 miles of trenches along the Western Front created this massive static line, this huge siege. And going back into the history of warfare, when there'd been sieges before, the sieges of positions or castles, it wasn't uncommon for one side to dig underneath the other and lay a charge of explosive to try and blow them up. In the case of sieges of castles, it was to bring down the castle walls to allow the troops to come flooding in. Now, there were no castles as such on the Western Front, but I suppose the nearest to the castle walls were the trench systems. And these miners, used by all sides during the Great War, this is essentially what their task was about, to bring down those trench systems to enable the stalemate of trench warfare to be brought to an end. Now, in the British Army, as I say, there were no tunnellers when we went to war in 1914, but when it became static, ad hoc tunnelling units were formed. They had a variety of names depending on what units operated them. They were drawn not so much from the Royal Engineers, but from miners who were serving in infantry units. For example, here in Flanders, there was one that had a lot of men from the Monmouthshire Regiment in it, which was a Welsh territorial battalion that had quite a lot of ex-miners amongst its ranks. Miners were not prohibited from military service, and when Britain went to war in 1914, a lot of them left the mines, joined the infantry, or were pre-war territorials or reservists and went straight off to war. in the episode that we looked at Mamet's Wood in the podcast, I spoke about Albert Chesters, who was a soldier in the 17th Royal Welsh Fusiliers. And he was a miner in Wrexham, never fired a gun, only ever done mining since he left school when he was 12. And he went straight into the infantry when the war broke out, because this was an opportunity for him to leave the darkness of the pit, come up into the sunlit world, and perhaps do something before that war ended by Christmas. But of course, it went on a lot longer than Christmas, and miners like him were serving all over the battlefields of the First World War, not just here on the Western Front. So with these ad hoc units, they carried out small-scale mining activities in places like Hill 60, for example, just outside Ypres. The French were doing the same. They blew mines in late 1914 on parts of their front, and the Germans were doing the same. They didn't form tunnelling units as such. It was their pioneer battalions that took on the task of military mining, and that was something that would continue for most of the rest of the war. But as I say, in the British Army, these ad hoc units in 1915 were brought together into tunnelling companies of the Royal Engineers. And there's a fascinating history going from those ad hoc units to the formation of the tunnellers. And I think at some point in the podcast, which I've probably said before, we will do a special episode on military mining of the Great War. But Norton Griffiths, who became that great spokesperson for the tunnellers, who went to Kitchener to try and convince him to form this unit of military miners, was the one that pushed this forward. And so in 1915, these tunnelling companies of the Royal Engineers, as I say, were formed, and they brought in men who were serving in the army, who were miners, to come in and do this work, formalise the kind of work that was going on in different parts of the British sector of the Western Front, which at that time only ran from Ypres down to northern France, close to the town of Le Bassée along the Le Bassée Canal. We hadn't yet extended our line that far south at this particular point. And to bring up the numbers that were required to make these units function, they began to recruit miners back home in Britain to come out and serve. So right across the coal fields here in South Yorkshire, around Barnsley and Rotherham and Doncaster, miners step forwards to join up, and they were given a carrot to do that, which was pay. The minimum pay for a miner was 6 shillings a day. Now in the infantry it was 1 shilling, so this was quite an incentive to step forward and to join the army. And in the coal mines in Britain at that time, there'd been a lot of coal production at the beginning of the war to probably feed the necessity that the war had brought for increased use of coal, but the prices of coal had come down, and as such the wages in the collieries came down as well. So what the army was offering them was probably better than they were being paid at the time. So it was really not much of a decision to make to step forward and join up and join one of these tunnelling units. And you were then sent straight out to France, a little bit of basic training with the Royal Engineers down at Chatham, and then straight out to France to join one of the tunnelling companies, because essentially you already knew your job. You didn't need to be trained to become a tunneller. You were a miner and you were just carrying out a different type of task but using the same skills. And this caused a few problems, because they didn't really realise, some of them, I think, that they were soldiers. They didn't understand that they had to salute officers and stand at attention and things like that. So all of that kind of thing had to be eventually addressed. But these men began their troglodyte war beneath the Western Front, blowing up different positions and leading to this finest hour of the tunnellers, when thousands of them had worked on the Messines mines, resulting in these 19 massive explosions and destroying the German positions at different points, enabling, certainly contributing to victory in that battle of 1917. So this modern memorial depicts one of these tunnellers, and it's a great bit of sculpture, but the thing that people notice immediately is that he's got an entrenching tool in his hand. Now, this is an infantry entrenching tool that every soldier carried in either his webbing gear or his leather patent equipment, depending on what type of kit that he was wearing. But it wasn't really used in any kind of extensive way by the tunnellers. They used specialist mining tools, and this was a bit of a blunt instrument, I suspect, to them. But it's a nice memorial, and I'll put a picture of it on the podcast website, oldfrontline.co.uk, so you can see what it's like, and it's worth a visit. And it brings together the stories of those tunnellers here at Messines in 1917, and is a bit of a focal point for that, which is a good thing. From here, we'll go to our right into the village square at Wychyard. So there's a rather ornate and rather lovely bandstand in the middle of it. And it kind of echoes the world before the Great War, when this was a small rural Flemish village. And this was probably the centrepiece for market day and also events within the village itself. This village, like all of those in Flanders, completely destroyed in the Great War. There's nothing here from the pre-war days, no original buildings. Everything was just rubble by 1918, because there wasn't just fighting here in 1917. The Germans had occupied this sector of the ridge since October 1914, since the First Battle of Ypres, and it had come under shell fire from the British throughout that period leading up to its capture in 1917. And then part of the British line, it came under fire from the Germans. In April 1918, they came across the Messines Ridge in the Battle of the Lys, and the area around the village was destroyed again in that fighting. And in the late summer of 1918, in what would eventually become the Fourth Battle of Ypres, in September, October of that year, there was fighting as Allied troops crossed the ridge again and pushed the Germans back. So after all of that to-ing and fro-ing, and more importantly, the huge amount of bombardments, all of the other villages around Ypres were just dust by the end of the conflict. Now, the church that we can see as we walk away from it, crossing the village square near the bandstand, is quite a distinctive one, and it sits on a high point on the ridge. And when you're back from it, close to or behind the former British front lines, it is one of those churches that you can see along the whole vista of the Messines Ridge. But we'll walk away from that now, taking a road over in the right-hand corner of the square, the Stanitsa Straat, that will take us down the hill slightly onto the main road of the N365. And this is the Ypres to Messines road. We're just going to turn off to the left and walk a little way up towards some of the modern houses there, and we'll stop here, and that'll be our next stop. When we stand in this street here, there is nothing apparent from the Great War. There's no cemetery here, there's no memorial. It's some very delightful modern Belgian houses, some shops, and it's the main road that links Ypres to Messines, and beyond that, the border of northern France. So it's quite a busy road. So why have we come down here? Well, it's the scene of what I think is one of the classic photographs of the Great War, certainly in that early period of the Great War. There were no official photographers in 1914, and we rely on imagery from that period, from officers who took their own cameras, from a few press photographers, and the odd War Office appointed or semi-appointed individual that went out and took a camera with them and photographed some units. Corporal Pilkington of the Artist Rifles, who's on attachment to the Scots Guards, is a good example of that, I think. But this photograph shows men of the Indian Army dug in along a barricade along this road in October of 1914. And again, I'll put that photograph on the podcast website, and it's worth having a look at that now as we talk about it, so you can see the sort of photograph that I'm talking about. And what this shows is actually men from the 57th Wild Rifles. It's according to the accounts of the battalion, it shows Punjabi Musulmen of the Punjabi Musulmen Company of that regiment. So these were Muslim soldiers, which is a really important thing to remember when we discuss the Great War, is this great swathe of different religions that serve within the Indian Army and the contribution of Muslims to the victory of the First World War and the fighting on the Western Front, and indeed other fronts within the Great War itself. This unit, part of the Indian Corps, came across to France in the early autumn of 1914. These were units that were in India when the war broke out, so they were not part of the original BEF, the British Expeditionary Force, which was made up of British divisions that were in Britain at the time, largely in England. But the size and scope of what this war was rapidly turning into necessitated the arrival of what was then described as Empire troops, Commonwealth troops as we call them now, and Indian Army soldiers were brought across by ship to Marseille. When they got off the docks at Marseille, the French were absolutely fascinated with the Indian Army. They photographed them with huge amounts of photographs of them on the docks and coming up onto the railway systems and marching up the roads. And there's lots of contemporary photographs and postcards of that, which is well worth seeking out. And then they moved up to take part in the fighting both in northern France near to Neuve-Chapelle, and there's a previous episode about the Indian Corps at Neuve-Chapelle that we did for the podcast a few months ago that's worth seeking out. And they also took part in what was then the first Battle of Ypres, fought in this area in October and November of 1914. Now, one thing that we see when we look at this photograph, we see one of the white officers, and most of the officers in these Indian units were British officers from Anglo-Indian families, perhaps, or had gone out to India to be commissioned in the Indian Army. But by 1914, there was an increasing number of Indian officers in these units as well. So that was a change that had taken place in the lead-up to the First World War. And we also see that they're wearing what are khaki drill KD uniforms. So these are light tan uniforms. They're not thick green khaki serge, because these men have come from India where it's pretty hot. But now they've arrived in a European theatre of war, the first time that Indian soldiers have been used in Europe in their history. And this type of uniform, which was fine for the Northwest frontier or campaigning in South Africa or wherever, was not, as they would discover, very suitable for wearing in the wet and muddy trenches of the Western Front. So this would cause a few issues. But like I say, it's a classic image, this, I think. And I think it's important that we see these images. And this is Black History Month at the moment, and it's important that we remind ourselves of the contribution of men from many different nations who serve within the British Armed Forces, not just in units like the British West Indies Regiment, or in this case, the Indian Army, but Black British soldiers who served in the British Army at different points during the war. And again, there is a previous podcast episode about the forgotten Black Army of the First World War. So when this photograph was taken, when you stand here now, you can just see houses on your right-hand side, and you think, well, why were they dug in here? Well, there were no houses there then. The pre-war maps of this village show that this was open fields where they were dug in. So they'd basically pulled some material out of sheds and houses and perhaps a couple of factories or farms and constructed this barricade as an impromptu firing position for when the Germans arrived. And indeed, they did arrive in strength on the 30th of October 1914, one of those key moments in the First Battle of Ypres, as the Germans in this area pushed the British and French troops that were here back over the ridge, took the ridge and held on to it until the Battle of Messines here on the 7th of June 1917. And the 57th Rifles, who are seen in this photograph, had been defending the village since the 26th of October, so they were here for 4 or 5 days. When they came under attack on the 30th, they were facing overwhelming numbers in terms of the Germans that were coming at them, but they fought hard here and suffered heavy losses. There were 6 British officers killed or wounded, 4 Indian officers, and 196 men killed, wounded, and missing. The majority, if not all, of the dead from that action are commemorated on the Meningate Memorial at Ypres. Many men from that early war period killed in places like Wichita or Messines do not have a known grave. They may well have been buried on the battlefield at the time, but with 4 years of war ahead, the chances of those graves surviving right until the end of the conflict in places like this were pretty slim. So, again, when we go to the Meningates, always have a look at those Indian Army names that are on there and remember the sacrifice of men who came from almost the other side of the world to fight here in a very different world, a very different environment to the one that they were used to, but to stand fast and do their bit and really set a precedent for the involvement and the sacrifice of Indian soldiers for a big chunk of the 20th century fighting alongside the British Army. For many years, there were very few Indian, modern Indian visitors to the Western Front. Since the centenary, that has changed a lot. More and more come. And outside of COVID times, that is, of course, possible. And I myself have brought Indian groups from Britain to the battlefields. It's a very rewarding experience to do that. And also for them to see how much they are remembered on these battlefields, because the typical tour groups that visit the Western Front don't omit this story. I mean, there is a belief that somehow these men are forgotten. And I think possibly in a wider extent, there is a degree of truth in that. But when you come to these battlefields and you go to the Menin Gate or the Indian Corps Memorial at Neuve Chapelle, or you go to one of the Indian cemeteries, you can't help but see the sacrifice of nations like India. And I think that's something that many visitors to these battlefields take away with them. And that can only be a good thing. So we'll do an about face now and we'll walk to the south from here, down the N365 towards the village of Messines, or Mersen, as you see on the signs today, to where we get to the outskirts of the village of Witschater, and a little minor road goes off to the left close to a little cafe, and that'll be our next stop. We've come off the main road now onto a minor road, the Langebundestraat, and this heads across the Messines Ridge from where we're standing. We passed a little cafe on the corner, which was the Tram Stop Cafe, and there was a tram route that ran along this road from Ypres down to Messines via Witschater in the interwar period. I'm not entirely sure when it disappeared, possibly just after the Second World War, but you certainly see the tracks of these trams in some of the interwar photographs, so it was definitely running then. And the little cafe, I think, was a cafe where you could wait for the tram to come along and have a little espresso or perhaps a little shot of a cafe rum or whatever before you got on the tram and went off to do whatever you did. But we've come down the little side road now onto this part of the Messines Ridge. And as we mentioned, the battle here in 1917 was one of the most successful that the British fought during the static war period of the Western Front. The mobile battles of later on in the war were very obviously very different to this. But to break the stalemate of trench warfare on the scale that Messines did truly made it into a very important battle. And there's a number of reasons for that, the tunnellers, the use of those mines, but also the improvement in tactics with infantry, as we mentioned, and artillery and tanks and aircraft, all of which were a feature of this assault working together in a way that they hadn't done before. Now, that was still to be perfected, and we would see, you know, to a degree, the high peak of that in those 1918 attacks from Amiens through to the end of the war. But here, this was an important turning point in that approach to the war. Lessons learnt from the Somme the previous year, applied here, it meant it was much more of a professional army. And commanded by General Plumer, the forces that fought at Messines in 1917 were highly trained for this battle in a way that hadn't really previously happened. Everybody down to section corporals were shown or even given a map. That's something we might take for granted. Surely every soldier had a map to show where he was on the battlefields. But at the beginning of the war, particularly with this influx of civilian soldiers, there was a belief that somehow these men would not be able to understand what was required of them and understand maps and know how to use maps. So you had to teach them how to fight by routine, by routes, as the Americans would say. And it hadn't worked, because if you create an army of automatons, when those in charge of them are killed or wounded, the whole thing breaks down. So Plumer decided to trust his men, to give them the information that they required to fight their battle, whether that be maps, whether that be training. They constructed models of the Messines battlefield, and every unit that took part in the attack was taken to one of these models and given a talk by a staff officer to show them what their unit was doing, what their brigade was doing, what their division was doing, and what the units on their flanks were doing. And there was a risk with this, because if men were captured in the lead up to the battle in a German trench raid, they could potentially give that information away and the Germans would know we were coming. But Plumer thought it was worth the risk, and I think he was right, because in this battle there were casualties, not on the scale of the Somme or Arras, but with every man knowing what his task was, what his neighbour's task was, it created a more efficient army capable of winning these types of battles. So in that respect, Messines was a clear turning point in not just the history of the British Army in the Great War, but in the whole history of the Great War, in the way that soldiers were subsequently trained in preparation for battle. So we're going to take a walk now across, and we've often called parts of the Somme the forgotten Somme. And I think down here around Messines, people go to Messines itself, the New Zealand Memorial in the centre of the town, they go there, and the Irish Peace Tower. But they don't go off the beaten track around Messines, and I think that's where the battlefield is at its best. And this part of the Ypres salient, the battlefields around Ypres, is much less developed than in the area to the east and the northeast around Passchendaele, for example. Here it's much more rural, much more like northern France around Arras or on the Somme, and it makes it great for walking in that respect. And we're going to follow a route over the Messines Ridge now and have a look along the way at three isolated battlefield cemeteries, all of which are connected in one way or another. So we'll continue down this minor road now until we get to some farm buildings on the left, where there's a path, a signed path, heading across the fields to a military cemetery, and that'll be our next stop. As we walk out to this cemetery, Torican Farm Cemetery number 1, we're walking along a path with barbed wire fences on both sides. It takes us across the farmers' fields, which normally have cattle in them, to the cemetery itself. So it's in quite an isolated situation. It's one of three cemeteries that we'll see on this walk, all of which are original battlefield cemeteries made during the war. And the thing that links them all together is a British unit, the 11th Northern Division. Now, they were in reserve for the attack on Messines, followed up in this area the men from the Ulster Division who came up over the ridge and captured this ground on the first day of the battle. The 11th Northern then followed them up, moved into the lines that were captured beyond the ridge, and held that against German counterattacks for the rest of the battle, and indeed for much of the rest of that summer. And all three of these cemeteries were made by divisional burial officers or by units within that formation. And this one, Torican Farm Cemetery No. 1, was started by the 5th Battalion, the Dorsetshire Regiment, in June 1917, about the time of the Battle of Messines, to bury their dead. And then it was used as a frontline cemetery up until April of 1918. And as we mentioned in what was called the Battle of the Lys, German soldiers attacked in this area, pushed the British and Commonwealth forces back over the Messines Ridge. So this ground taken in 1917 was lost in a few days in April 1918. The units that were here could not stand this ground in the weight of the German forces that were coming at them. The Germans pushed them back with devastating bombardments, and the Messines Ridge was retaken in that battle. And cemeteries like this then became part of the German rear area again, just like this ground had been before Messines itself. So where we are now, we're on a ridge, part of the ridge, that slopes away from Wycharta. So prior to the Battle of Messines in 1917, the Germans could probably freely move around here without being seen directly by the British on the other side of no man's land. But after the capture of the ridge, this ground faced the flatlands towards the village of Hollerbeek, where from there the Germans could see up onto this part of the ridge. So the movement over open ground, certainly in daylight hours, was pretty tricky. It's a small cemetery. There are 70 British burials here, 20 Australian, because once the British units moved out, often to go to the other side of Ypres to take part in the Third Battle of Ypres from July 1917 onwards, the Australians held this sector. They'd have been involved in the capture of the ground just to the south of Messines on the 7th of June near to Plug Street Wood, for example, which we've discussed in a previous podcast. But then they moved into this sector and held different parts of the Messines Ridge for quite some time on and off in 1917 and on into early 1918 as well. And after the capture of this ground in the Battle of the Lys, the Germans tacked on their own burial ground here with the dead from that battle. Now, I don't know how many Germans were buried here at that time. There's nothing in the original Imperial War Graves Commission register that indicates how many German burials there were, but this wasn't untypical. There were quite a few British cemeteries in 1918 that were used by the Germans to bury their own dead. In some cases, the dead remain there. There's some in Hyde Park Corner Cemetery, for example. In others like this one, they were removed and buried elsewhere. And up until the 1950s, there were quite a few German cemeteries on the southern part of the battlefield, along the other side, as it were, of the Messines Ridge. All of those were subsequently closed and moved into places like Menin or Langemark, into the Kameradengrab and the mass graves there. So I suspect these men are in one of those two cemeteries, probably more likely Menin Cemetery, which is the biggest German cemetery. People think it's Langemark, but Menin has got 48,000 burials in it, a staggering number, many of them brought into the cemetery from locations like this. When we come in to see the British graves, you see a lot of different units from battalions within that 11th Northern Division, some men from the 5th Battalion Dorsets who started this cemetery. But we also see a couple of men from the Royal Flying Corps. Now, because of Blackadder, and Blackadder is a great comedy series, had a lot of effect on our perception of the First World War and probably drawn a lot of people into the subject of the First World War and got them interested and fascinated by it. But of course, it is comedy, not a documentary. And one of the episodes is about when Blackadder goes to join the Royal Flying Corps. And we know from that the Royal Flying Corps are the 20-minuters. And he thinks that's the average amount of time you have to spend in the air doing your fighting every day. Then you can come home and go to the mess. The reality is he discovers that was your life expectancy. Now, as I say, comedy, not a documentary. But there is an inkling of truth in this. The best comedy is always grounded in truth, because the life expectancy of pilots on the Western Front, particularly in 1917 with, at Arras, Bloody April, when the Germans had the upper hand in aircraft technology and were shooting British aircraft down in such great numbers, the life expectancy was very short. And we've got an example of that here with the grave of Paul Rudder Kenatchee. He was born in Calcutta in 1898. His father was involved in business there. He was then subsequently educated at Rugby, a private school, and he was still at school, age 16, when the war broke out in 1914. Now, many teenagers like him, I suspect, probably wanted to step forward like those had already left the school and go and join the army, but that wasn't possible. He had to wait another couple of years. And at age 18, he joins the Royal Naval Air Service and then is transferred to the Royal Flying Corps. He does 30 hours training, and training was a very difficult and potentially deadly aspect of joining the Royal Flying Corps, because there were no simulators. You got in an aircraft and you took off and you learnt how to fly. And the easy bit, I suspect, was the taking off bit. The difficult bit was landing again. And thousands of pilots in training during the First World War crashed and were either killed or injured in that process, some never going on to fly in combat during the war at all because of this. He then went to France on the 5th of July 1917, just 16 weeks after beginning his pilot training, and he was posted to 53 Squadron Royal Flying Corps based at Balliol, where he would fly an RE8 aircraft, which was a two-man aircraft with a pilot and an observer. Balliol was the headquarters of fighter squadrons that served in this part of the Ypres salient. There was a big aerodrome there close to the mental asylum at Balliol, which many of those who served there thought was appropriate given the incredible Heath Robinson nature of the aircraft that they flew, and going back to their life expectancy, not quite 20 minutes, but certainly short. A lunatic asylum seemed the perfect place to be based at when you were in the Royal Flying Corps. Posted to this active squadron, part of his responsibilities was to take his aircraft with his observer up over the German lines along the Messines Ridge. This was July 1917. The Battle of Messines had already taken place. The Germans had been pushed over the ridge, were holding the line near to the village of Hollebeek. And aircraft like that went up often to observe for artillery units and take air photos. The observer would take a camera with him and then take photographs over the side of the aircraft showing the German positions there. And just after 20 days, while on one of these patrols, his aircraft was attacked by a German scout and he was killed by machine gun fire at the controls of his aircraft. So not quite 20 minutes, 20 days, but that was a very, very short life expectancy for a young pilot like him. His observer was Second Lieutenant Norman Watt, and he tried to take over the controls, which meant he had to clamber somehow out of the observer's seat, try and push the body of his dead comrade, of his pilot, to one side and grab the control stick and try and take over the flying of the aircraft, which was nigh on impossible, and possibly he didn't even really know how to do it, but the aircraft span out of control and it crashed here at Torrican Farm. Watt sadly died of his wounds, and him and Paul Rodinacci are buried side by side here. They were buried by the chaplain of the 13th Battalion, the Rifle Brigade, who were holding this part of the battlefield at that time and saw the aircraft crashed, went out to recover the pilot and the observer. Pilot was dead, and sadly Norman Watt died shortly afterwards, and as I say, they were buried here side by side. But this was an area of quite intense aircraft activity, so aerial combat and also the use of aircraft to by both sides to scout out each other's locations, photograph things from the air, and obviously use their artillery to try and destroy those things that they found by taking those photographs. And another pilot who was flying over this part of the battlefield at that time, the same time as these two lads, was William Robinson Clark. Now, he was a sergeant pilot who had come from Jamaica in 1914 to serve in the British Army. He'd been a chauffeur before the war and had good mechanical skills and had been part of the ground crew of the Royal Flying Corps, but had then been put in for pilot training. So he was a black pilot, probably the first black pilot of African Caribbean descent who served in the Royal Flying Corps, served in the British Aviation Services in the Great War. There were some Indian pilots who served, but he was almost certainly the first African Caribbean to fly in combat above the trenches of the Western Front. We told his story in that episode on black soldiers in the Great War, and he also appears in my book, Great War Lives. And for Black History Month this month, I've seen lots of tweets about his story, about his life, which is a really great thing to see, because for many, many years his story was completely unknown. So when we come to a little cemetery like this, we see the men killed on the ground in the trenches and holding the line and in ration parties and whatever, but also we find graves of two men from the Royal Flying Corps, and that helps us to understand a little bit more about the war above the Western Front, which was just as important. And in this episode, we've essentially looked at all three, with the Tunnellers Memorial, the war beneath the front, in cemeteries like this, the men who were killed on the front line, and then with these two graves of pilots and observer, we look at the war that took place in the skies above Flanders and above other parts of the battlefields. So from here, we'll return down that wire-lined path back to the road. We'll turn left. We'll walk down a little way. Now, this is where the map that I've put on the website diverges slightly, because it tries and takes you a different route. But a little bit further down, there's a minor road going past a farm on the left. We take that. We come to the end of that. We turn right, walk down a little way, and then we turn left, and that takes us to the next cemetery, which will be our next stop. We're now on a minor road, Krommerstraat, and we're standing outside Derry House Cemetery number 2, so named almost certainly because of Irish troops that served in this part of the battlefield. This is the largest of the three battlefield cemeteries that we visit on this walk, and there's 126 British burials here and 37 Australians. It was started by units of the 32nd Brigade of the 11th Northern Division, so that continuation, that connection with that unit continues here with this cemetery as well, and it was used extensively by their field ambulances. So there was an advanced dressing station somewhere near to here that the Royal Army Medical Corps received wounded, and some of the men brought in there died of their wounds, and they were buried here. And it was begun again during the Battle of Messines in June of 1917 and remained in use as a frontline cemetery up until December of that year. So it closed a little bit earlier than the other two cemeteries that we'll see. However, it was then used again in the fighting in the Fourth Battle of Ypres in 1918 and remained in use until October of that year, latterly by the men of the 2nd Battalion, the London Scottish, officially the 2nd 14th Battalion, London Regiment, in brackets London Scottish. Now, the 2nd London Scottish were formed in 1914 when the original battalion fought just down the road from here at Messines at Halloween. That was a pre-war territorial battalion that had very high numbers of recruits, had signed up for Imperial service, and was one of the very first territorial battalions to be sent overseas in the war, and would become the first territorial infantry battalion to see action in the Great War. So with that battalion already full, with wartime recruits coming in, the London Scottish formed a second and then a third battalion, which was like a feeder battalion to send reinforcements to the other two. And the second London Scottish became part of the 60th London Division, which was made up of second line territorial battalions of the London Regiment, served in northern France in 1916, then in Salonika, and then went off to Palestine. And there's a very, very good account of service with the London Scottish called Kilts Across the Jordan. It's a book that's out of print, but I think there is a digital download of it that you can get. Well worth seeking out. So they fought in some of those even more forgotten battlefields out there, Salonika and in the fighting in Palestine against the Ottoman Turks. And then the brigade that they were in, so four battalions of the London Regiment, were then pulled out of the 60th Division and sent to France in 1918, where they joined the 30th Division, which had been a unit made up of POWs battalions from the Manchester Regiment and the King's Liverpool Regiment, and they fought with them in the battles here in the Fourth Battle of Ypres in Flanders in that September-October period, and buried some of their dead here. So when we see the graves of these London Scottish men, we walk along them, these are men who may well have served on three different fronts in the Great War. France, twice. First in 1916, and then Salonika, then Palestine, and then back here again for the final battles. So these are men that, compared to other soldiers of the Great War who just came straight out to the Western Front, were certainly well travelled. We also see by looking at the Australian graves that 29 of the 37 Australian graves are from the 47th Battalion Australian Imperial Force, and by this stage in the war they'd fought in quite a few different battles. But there are some of the originals from the battalion buried here as well. But one of the features of this cemetery that makes it especially interesting is not so much the burials or the connection with the London Scottish and their wide, long journey across the battlefields of the Great War, but on the boundary wall of it, near to where the boundary meets the neighbouring farm, there is a wartime bunker, which you can see the roof of. And this is not a German bunker. We tend to think, as soon as we see concrete, German bunker. But once the ridge was captured in 1917, because of the fact that this was quite an exposed battlefield, the British Army constructed quite a few bunkers along the ridge, which you can see today, and this is one of them. This was made by Royal Engineer Field Companies from the British 37th Division, often called the English Division, because all of the battalions that were in it were from regiments that were from England, so no Scottish, no Welsh units in it, just all English regiments. And they were here in the late summer of 1917, and this bunker was constructed. Now, this type of bunker was not a defensive bunker, so there was no machine gun in it, and it was not really for the infantry either. This was almost certainly for the Royal Field Artillery units that had their gun sights here, and they would construct bunkers like this as a signals post, so the signallers of the unit could be set up in here in safety, receiving messages from the forward observation teams on the front line, directing the guns, relayed back to here, and then given to the men operating the guns to fire their artillery correctly in the right place and with maximum effect. So that's probably what this bunker was used for. Is it unique in a British cemetery of the Great War? It isn't, funny enough. There are a few examples of bunkers being part of the cemetery. Just down the road at Prowse Point Cemetery, for example, there is a bunker within the confines of the cemetery there. As you come in through the gate, go across to your right, you'll see the roof of the bunker there. So there are a few examples of this where bunkers now form part of British cemeteries from the Great War. Before we leave the cemetery, though, I wanted to point out a couple of interesting graves in here that I've come across as I've visited this cemetery. We used to do this on one of the walking Ypres tours that we've done with Ledger Holidays over the years. First of those is Lieutenant Stanley Oliver Brand. Now, he was an American serving in the British Army. He served with the 6th Battalion, the York and Lancaster Regiment, part of that 11th Northern Division, and was killed on the 14th of June 1917, right at the end of the Battle of Messines, aged 24. And he'd married Kate, who was from Doncaster, so that was the Yorkshire connection. And he was one of a large number of Americans that fought for Britain during the Great War. In 1914, many American citizens were outraged that America had not entered the war on the side of Britain and France and the others against Germany, And for them, their choice was to walk across the border into Canada and join the Canadian Expeditionary Force, which many of them did do, or come across to Paris and join the French Foreign Legion, which many of them did do. But some were in Britain when the war broke out, and they joined the British Army. I've mentioned that book before, A New York Actor on the Western Front by Harry Kendall. He was on the stage when the war broke out in Britain and joins the King Edward's Horse and then comes across to Flanders to serve. And in fact, several Americans serve with him. Just down the road from here are the graves of some Americans killed with the King Edward's Horse. So quite a few Americans served and were killed with the British Army during the Great War. There are quite a few memoirs that were published during the war of some of these Americans who were killed, and some of them ended up being transferred to the American Expeditionary Force when that arrived to take part in the war when America entered the conflict in 1917. Some years ago, I saw a group of medals to an officer who had served with the Worcestershire Regiment at Gallipoli and been awarded the Military Cross there and then fought on the Somme. He'd been born in America, come to Britain, served with this unit. Then in 1917, he transferred to the AEF, served with them as a unit commander, and then was killed in the Meuse-Argonne offensive in 1918. So quite an incredible war for an individual like that. And this grave here gives us a pointer to that aspect of the history of the Great War. Not far away is the grave of Captain Wilfred Thomas Channing Pierce. He was Royal Army Medical Corps, a regimental medical officer, serving with the 18th Battalion, the King's Liverpool Regiment, which is Liverpool POWs, or had originally been a Liverpool POWs battalion. He was born in London in 1885. He was educated at Rugby and Cambridge, and he worked as a doctor at Guy's Hospital from 1908. Now, like many doctors on the outbreak of war, he volunteered for war service. Some of them were reservists or special reservists in the Royal Army Medical Corps when the war broke out. But he joined the RAMC in October of 1914 and then became the Regimental Medical Officer, the RMO, of the 18th King's Liverpool Regiment on the Somme in the autumn of 1916. He was decorated with the Military Cross and Bar for bravery at Arras and the Third Battle of Ypres. And he was killed while going out to the frontline post in this sector on the 1st of October 1917. Now, he is a character that you've probably never heard of before. I'd not encountered him until I came to visit this cemetery some years ago. But I think when you come to cemeteries like this and you research some of these medical officers, you realise that Chavasse, VC and Barr, the most decorated medical officer of the Great War, the only one to win it twice, the Victoria Cross twice, during the war itself. And before him, Martin Leake getting his first Victoria Cross in the Boer War and the Bar at the First Battle of Ypres in 1914. Those are the two high-profile, highly decorated medical officers of the Great War. But there were hundreds, possibly thousands of them that served who we don't read so much about. And when you look at a character like Wilfred Thomas Channing Pierce and you see what he did, going out tirelessly to rescue and recover the wounded on battlefields like the Somme and Arras and in the opening stage of the Third Battle of Ypres, these are amongst the forgotten heroes in many respects of the Great War, working alongside their stretcher bearers, infantry soldiers going out, serving with them to pick up the wounded. To fight on these battlefields must have been horrendous. To go out under fire from the enemy to recover the wounded on stretchers, exposing yourself all the time, that is just almost unimaginable. But it's graves like this, when we stop and pause and look up some history behind these men, that we get an insight into this aspect of the Great War as well. So coming out the cemetery, we'll turn right onto Krommestraat, go back to the junction. This time we'll turn left and we'll go in a roughly sort of southern direction, following this track around. We'll get good views across the Messines Ridge, or this part of the Messines Ridge, as we walk down here. And the road winds a little bit as it heads down towards the next major junction, where a road goes off to the left. We'll take that, and then there's a path going around the back of some trees, and that brings us to our next and final military cemetery on this walk. You take a small path to get to this cemetery, Cabin Hill Cemetery. Quite why it had that name is not recorded. and it takes you around an area of trees on your right-hand side where there's an elongated pond in there, which could well be a number of connected shell holes turned into a water point for cattle after the war. This was quite a common thing by Belgian and French farmers, to exploit these holes in the ground made by artillery that were probably already full of water and turn them into places where their cattle could have a drink when this became farmland again, or the attempt to reclaim it as farmland took place in the early 1920s. It takes us round to what is the smallest of the three cemeteries that we'll see on this walk. And from here, we're on the slopes away from the ridge itself. We can't see much of the ground beyond it, but we're tucked away in a location away from where in 1917 and 18 the German lines were located. So the reason almost certainly this cemetery is here is because it was safe, relatively safe, to bury the dead here without being seen directly by the enemy on the other side of the battlefield. It's another cemetery made by men from the 11th Northern Division and started once again during the Battle of Messines in June of 1917. The 11th Northern Division had, just like those lads in the London Scottish, quite a long war. They'd gone off to fight in 1915, not on the Western Front, but at Gallipoli, and had served there right up until the evacuation in January of 1916. They then served in Egypt for a while before coming via Marseille to the Western Front. They'd taken part in the Battle of the Somme. We mentioned a little bit about their action at Mouquet Farm when we visited that part of the battlefield in a previous podcast. And then at Messines, occupied this sector for quite some time. So they've left, unlike a lot of units that rotated through here, they've left a little bit of a footprint of their service with these three little battlefield cemeteries started by them at that key moment during the Messines operations in June of 1917. And we've seen three small battlefield cemeteries here, which are quite unusual at Ypres, because in most cases these small cemeteries were closed and then moved into bigger ones. Quite how or why these ones survived and others didn't is somewhat lost, I would say, in the mists of time in many, many examples. So we'll probably never know the exact reason why these remain, but it's good that they do. Like the other cemeteries, this was used by frontline units to bury the dead up until, in this case, in March of 1918, just before that Battle of Lys when the Germans swept over the ridge. There's no notation that any Germans were subsequently buried here during those operations. So in terms of layout and burials, it's pretty much as it was during the war. There are 42 British graves here and 25 Australian. And again, this follows the theme of the burials that we've seen in all three cemeteries. The majority of them British, but in each case are not insubstantial in terms of the overall numbers, Australian burials as well, from what was essentially a quiet period. And when we've looked at the graves of the men that we've seen in these three cemeteries here, when I visit, I see a lot of men from the local regiment to me here in South Yorkshire, the York and Lancaster Regiment. There are men from both the 6th and the 10th Battalion buried in this cemetery, men from Sheffield and Doncaster who had served, in the case of the 6th Battalion, at Gallipoli in 1915. We see men not killed in big battles of the Great War buried here. We see men killed in the day-to-day of activity of trench warfare. Once the Messines Ridge was taken, once we'd made that big leap over the ridge from one side to the other and British and Empire forces had captured that ground and held it, it became static trench warfare. There was a diversionary attack near to Hollerbeek on the 31st of July 1917, which was part of the Third Battle of Ypres, but that was the biggest operation that took place there until the German offensive of April of 1918. In between those two periods, from July 1917 up until April 1918, it was holding the line here. So men were killed and wounded by shell fire, rifle grenades, gas attack, trench raids, snipers, all that kind of thing, which we've spoken about many times on this podcast. So not necessarily facing the enemy with bayonets fixed, making a glorious charge, but in some inconsequential corner of Flanders in a little shallow trench holding the line. That was the reality of many men's service and their death or wounding on the battlefield throughout the Great War. And I think really that is the power of places like this. We can go to Tyne Cot and get the sense of all those numbers, the sheer scale of the First World War. But for many people, they find it difficult to connect with the soldiers themselves in that vast landscape of the dead. But coming to these small soldiers' cemeteries, comrade cemeteries, as Martin Middlebrook called them in his books, you can somehow connect in a different way. There are very few unknown soldiers buried in these cemeteries. Most of them are known, so we know who they are, what their backgrounds were, where they came from, what they did. We can research their stories and in that way connect on a much deeper level with them. And I think that when you sit in a place like this and you reflect on events of more than 100 years ago with the birds singing in the trees behind the cemetery here at Cabin Hill, then those years since the war seem to somehow fall away again. These so-called silent cities, again, as we've said so many times in this podcast, never quite feel so silent when you sit here and you read the names, and those men seem to call to you from the past. And I think this is what will continue to draw us back to these places, will continue to draw future visitors to these places. And it's that, really, that connection to those ordinary men in extraordinary times. It's what makes it so fascinating to take these journeys along the old front line. You've been listening to an episode of The Old Front Line with me, military historian Paul Reed. You can follow me on Twitter at SomCor. You can follow the podcast at Old Front Line Pod. Check out the website at oldfrontline.co.uk, where you'll find lots of podcast extras and photographs and links to books that are mentioned in the podcast. And if you feel like supporting us, you can go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/oldfrontline, or support us on Buy Me A Coffee at buymeacoffee.com/oldfrontline. Links to all of these are on our website. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again soon.